When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Jules Breach, he's Andy Bressel, and this is Jules and Andy on Football Ramble Daily.
McTominay with a screamer, his first goal at Old Trafford, and then Aubameyang with that VAR equaliser. It's a point apiece at Old Trafford. Manchester United 1, Arsenal 1.
Coming up, we'll dissect the Monday night football between Manchester United and Arsenal. We'll also discuss the continuing troubles at Newcastle, and we'll get to your emails and tweets as well. But before we get started with today's show, Andy, first of all, we both had a rather nice time at the Football Ramble Live over the weekend, didn't we?
Yeah, you went posh and went to Ali Pally, and I kept it real and went to Hackney Empire.
I've never been to Hackney Empire, and it was my first time at Ali Pally, so how was it for you?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. Very, very enjoyable. And, you know, I don't think we could say that our bit was the best bit of the show. Well, we made a little side contribution, didn't we?
Me and Andy both have a bit of a cameo appearance via videotape during the show. If you haven't been yet, you must get to one of these Ramble Live shows. The boys were absolutely hilarious. I was in stitches from start to finish. Everything about it, it's exactly as you'd expect it to be. Although I hear there's slight differences to every single show, which is quite nice as well.
Yeah, I think for the opening musical number, they could have done with like Westlife style stools or, you know, Aging Take That when they start to like sort of sit on bar stools.
And then in the key change, they get up and then they go to their proper seats and sit down
for the show. That is the point at which Pete could take his shirt off.
Well, this is the thing, is you weren't treated to Pete getting half naked at your show, were you?
No, I wasn't.
It was the highlight of mine on Saturday night. He basically did his going for gold bit, and it was an absolute shambles because someone in the crowd got it right on the first clue, and he was furious about it and decided to take his shirt off. So that was entertaining, to say the least.
Which is funny because people normally take their shirts off at moments of great joy, like when they score a goal and they get a yellow card for it, don't they?
He did it in pure anger.
Did Marcus give him a yellow card for taking his shirt off?
He didn't, actually.
Did he not?
No.
Maybe he should have.
Maybe he should have.
So in terms of actual football, we've had a big Monday night match, which it kind of creaked under the historical weight of itself a little bit, because I don't know, we were chatting beforehand, weren't we, in the office, because we all watched it together with producer Charlie.
And lots of food. We ordered burgers, chicken wings, chips.
Oh, the soul wings. My goodness.
That was actually the highlight of my night. The football wasn't too good.
I think the fact that we're talking about the food says a lot, doesn't it? But it's interesting, because I was asking you guys, who are a little bit younger than me.
A little bit.
what were your favourite United versus Arsenal memories? And like mine came up straight away. And especially in the context of Old Trafford, I thought Overmars in 98. I thought Sylvain Wiltord's winner, which won them the championship in 2002. I thought way back in the early 90s, in 1990, where there was that massive fight on the touchline, there were point deductions afterwards and all the rest of it. Whereas you guys had to think about it a little bit longer, which made me think, well, you know, and a lot of the feedback we got from our lovely listeners, which we'll get to some of it in a minute, was focused on the fact that this was a disappointing spectacle. But I don't know really if it is a like Manchester United versus Arsenal. This has been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Well, there are two clubs that are in decline at the moment that are both trying to crawl their way back.
And have been for a while.
And in the lead up to the game, it's funny because I was listening to the radio on my way into the office, and there was a lot of build up to the match. And often with a game with two teams as big as they are historically, there would be so much to be said about it. But everyone's comments were kind of the same. Everyone was a little bit like, well, it's not the Man United and Arsenal that it used to be. So it's not going to be the same game that it used to be. This used to be a match which could potentially have decided the title. And today, coming into the game, it was 11th versus 8th.
Would it have been on Monday night in the old days?
Probably not.
No, I don't know if it would have been. And I think the fact that Sky, on which we watched it, of course, had Roy Keane in the studio. I understand he's relentlessly grumpy, but the first thing I think of still when I think of United versus Arsenal is Keenan Vieira. You know, it's very hard to get away from that iconic image. And after that, after not just that level in terms of the two teams being such high quality, and you know, when they battled it out in really the dawn of the Premier League years, and especially in the late 90s, you do sort of think, well, you know, it's not just about the quality. It's about the fact that those were two guys, particularly, they stick in your minds because they left everything on the pitch, and everything felt titanic. Everything felt like a struggle. And even when you think of the other memories from like Pizzagate with Cesc Fabregas and Ashley Cole, or when you think of that iconic image of Van Nistelrooy missing the penalty and Keown going up and roaring in his face, doesn't feel like there's any of that. I think there's talent on both sides, but there's not a lot of players you look at there and you think born winner. I mean, personally, looking at last night, I think the player who I was most drawn to was Matteo Guendouzi, just because he feels like maybe he's not quite there yet, but he feels like he's edging that sort of way, and he won't let the crapness of a game stop him from
that's
just
a word now
battling through it, will he? Do you know what
yeah,
I mean? He won't let the occasion drag him down. He's like, right, okay, we're going to battle our way through this. We're going to make something out of this. And as well as his intrinsic quality, he does have a little bit of that spirit, doesn't he?
He's got that attitude that I think...
Exactly, that's the word.
Fans want to see that, because that's something that's been missing for a while. It's something that... They get frustrated when they see Ozil because he lacks that type of outward emotion when it comes to playing the game and leaving everything out on the pitch, as you were just saying about Vieira and Roy Keane. And Guendouzi does have that. And it's interesting that being a younger member of that squad and being a fairly newer member of the team as well, that he was in Arsenal's weird vote for captaincy and he made that shortlist, which shows exactly what an impact he's having on that team, both on the pitch and in the dressing room as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I want to get some of the listener feedback from this, because you have got involved and we're very thankful for that. A lot of it talking about the quality of the game. Joe Matthews saying, how can such a big build-up to a game being followed by the professional football equivalent of putting 22 players on a wet bouncy castle and kicking the ball in the general direction of the opponent's goal?
Accurate.
Great question, Joe. Daryl Geraghty, worst standard of football between these two teams in how many years? I felt it was quite rubbish last year, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was an entertaining enough game, the 2-2 draw at Old Trafford, but I did feel almost a little bit of an emptiness. It felt like having a McDonald's rather than a GBK, really, last year.
Or a beer and burger like we had tonight.
For example. All sponsorship encouraged. interesting one here, like quite a few people, including Alex Holcomb, saying, is Pepe the new Jovino? Ebening saying, did Lille have player Papa instead of Pepe? Something is off with the one Arsenal got. I have a bit of sympathy for Nicolas Pepe because he cost an extraordinary amount of money on the back of an absolutely tremendous season for Lille, but on the back of a tremendous season where he was the centre of everything. He was the orchestrator for that team. Now, I don't think they really know where the conductor in that team is meant to be. Is it Ozil? No, because he's not in the team at the moment. Is it Ceballos? Well, he's in and out of the team. Where does Pepe fit when Lacazette and Aubameyang is there? And he's kind of expected to play a little bit like Lacazette at the moment. And that's not really his sort of game. I mean, he needs space to run into. So theoretically, he should work very well for an Unai Emery team. But I don't think they have a dedicated spot for him yet. And I think that's what he needs to find to really adapt. I can understand Arsenal fans being disappointed because it cost an awful lot of money and he has underwhelmed a little bit so far. But with all due respect to Pepe, who I admire enormously, and I thought he was great in France, better players than him have taken 6 months to settle in the Premier League is the only caveat I would add.
Arsenal fans will obviously be disappointed that he's yet to score a goal from open play, because the only goal he's scored so far has been what I would call a bit of a sympathy penalty, because Aubameyang should be taking the penalties for Arsenal and he handed over the ball to Pepe last week to take that penalty.
Pepe is objectively a better penalty taker than Aubameyang. I would say that.
Would you?
Yeah, I would. So even if there is a hierarchy, I think there's reason behind that.
Yeah, but you know, you've summed him up really in that he's underwhelmed so far for Arsenal. And,
yes.
And part of it is probably to do with what you've been saying there, that what is his role and how does he fit into this team when everyone's fit and everyone's available to play? And that'll be really interesting to see.
Do they know their best 11? Are they close to knowing their best 11? I mean, a couple of other listeners, quite a few others have asked about what is Unai Emery's plan? Because he's someone who's known for eye for tactical detail. That's not particularly apparent at the moment, is it?
It's not.
They're kind of a mush, aren't they?
You feel it with watching both of the teams tonight, though, don't
fair,
you?
That
there's not really an identity to either of them in the style that they play, except that they're both, at the moment, defensively, not very good.
Who do you think's closer to forging an identity out of these two teams? Because I would say, at least with United, I do feel that they're not going to concede a lot of goals at home, which is a start. Is that fair?
I don't know if I'm completely with you on that. I see both teams being... I suppose that with the addition of Maguire, but then you look at the goal that Manchester United conceded against Arsenal last night, it was his fault because he was playing Aubameyang onside. But I don't necessarily think I've seen much of an improvement to Manchester United since Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka arrived. And I know Aaron Wan-Bissaka didn't play against Arsenal because he was injured. But for me, there has been no improvement to Manchester United since last year at all. I can't see how anything's improved, despite the fact that they added two very good defenders to the team. I don't think they're playing any better. I don't think their style has improved. I haven't looked directly into the stats of how many goals they've conceded at this stage of the season compared to this stage last season, but I imagine it won't be that far different.
No, and I think in fairness, when we're looking at Manchester United improving, it's always going to be the front half of the team we're looking at because of what they did in the first 15, 20 years of the Premier League. Mm-hmm. We expect a certain something from them. And, you know, maybe Harry Maguire, we talked, didn't we, Jules, at the start of the season about what can he actually do to be what Virgil van Dijk is for Liverpool? And the answer is there's nothing he can really do to be what Virgil van Dijk is for Liverpool, because Harry Maguire can play a 10 out of 10 game every game this season if he wants to. It will not make Manchester United champions. It will not make Manchester United anywhere close to being Premier League champions, because Van Dijk was one of the players, along with Alisson and to a lesser extent, I suppose, Fabinho and the emerging Trent Alexander-Arnold, one of the players that pushed Liverpool over the top from a good team to an absolute elite team.
Yeah.
And United just aren't in that position. That's not Maguire's fault, is it?
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that Van Dijk and Alisson, they were the missing pieces to the puzzle at Liverpool that needed to complete that team and get them to the top, top level in the Premier League. Whereas with Manchester United, Harry Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka weren't the only things that Manchester United needed. They still need to add a lot more to this squad for it to be challenging for a title, in my opinion. And when you look at the manager in charge as well with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I know a lot of questions are being asked now and he's under extreme pressure. And I do really feel for him because this is a massive, massive job.
Yes.
And it's a club that he supports. So the last thing he wants to do is fail at this job. But at the moment, he's not doing what a Manchester United manager should be doing for the club.
But can he?
But can, I mean, and that's
the question. Is he set to fail? Is he set up to fail by the fact that there's no management structure there, that there's no real plan there?
It looks that way. And when you look at the numbers as well, United have only won 49 points from the 28 Premier League games since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took charge. That's actually 2 points less than United won in their final 28 matches under Jose Mourinho. And we saw the uproar in that last phase of Mourinho's spell at Manchester United and how sort of brutal it got for him.
Well, I think when you level that up as well, I'd love to see the numbers broken down, because he started really well, certainly in terms of results. I mean, I remember the last time I saw United in the flesh was, I would have been a couple of days into January when they played away at Newcastle, and they were on a proper rip then. It was about, I guess, just under a month since he got the job, and they were on a tear. They were winning game after game after game. But, you know, it's something I always come back to about how we use the result to justify what's happened and work backwards rather than actually analysing the game itself. And, you know, the headline that night was, you know, United roll on, United continue their good run. Mm. But against one of the poorest sides in the division, they were maybe a smidgen better. They weren't loads better than Newcastle by any means. And it took them a while to break through them. And it was a very flat, very flawed performance in which they didn't defend well and in which a better team than Newcastle would have put a couple of goals on them. And we'll come to Newcastle in a little bit, but that's a different story. So since that initial run of results has dissipated, that is always the problem, isn't it? When you're not producing identity football or football of a certain plan or of a very firm imprint, that when the results go, what's actually left? Not much.
Yeah, and it was reflective on the pitch at Old Trafford last night against Arsenal. It was just a bit grim, wasn't it? Just a bit of a stalemate. We were expecting it to be a bit feistier. There were a few tackles thrown in here and there, but in the pouring rain in Manchester as well, we expected it to be a lot more than what it was.
Well, exactly. I mean, there was one big interception. I think it was from Xhaka early on, where because it had been raining so heavily, he stretched for it and then skidded all the way across the pitch. And he thought, okay, well, you know, this could be fun. I mean, John Windmill's written here and said, what is Granit Xhaka good at? Skidding, I would say. He's excellent at skidding.
We've witnessed that in the game last night. He's very good at skidding.
Undisputable.
Well, the point apiece for both teams means that Manchester United are left in 10th place in the table and Arsenal are in 4th.
Just where they want to be.
Yeah, exactly.
In the top 4.
didn't you say someone tweeted as well? We were reading through the tweets. Someone asked, where we think they're going to finish by the end of the season and who's going to finish higher and lower. I can't remember who sent that in.
Yeah, that's right. I will find that tweet at some point. I'm wading through an absolute pile.
It's so popular, Andy. So many people have tweeted you. You can't find it.
We are so popular. The Ramble is so popular.
Well, what do you think? Do you think it's going to be Arsenal? Do you think Arsenal can stay in the top four?
I'm not 100% convinced. I mean, we were saying, weren't we, when we sat there watching it, who's going to be the happiest watching this? Leicester.
Yeah.
If you're in Jamie Vardy's front room, you are having a party.
Jamie Vardy's party, yeah.
It feels pretty good, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, we'll get on to Leicester when we talk about Newcastle in a bit. But once again, they've had another brilliant weekend. They'll be looking at the likes of Manchester United and Arsenal, who played each other last night, and be thinking, if that's what we're competing with to get into the top four, we're in a pretty good place.
Yeah, and there's a deeply flawed Chelsea, even though there's a lot of promise there. There's a lot of stuff to work with. And that's why we look at Chelsea slightly different from Manchester United and Arsenal, because you feel at least they're building something quite organic, which, you know, Chelsea fans have every right to feel excited about. I would say, if you were looking at both United and Arsenal, I feel there's more room to improve for Arsenal. I just don't really see where United are going, period. Of course, that they have got young players of promise, but I think that Arsenal will at some point find a tactical plan. They will find their best 11. There are players there who are going to get better. And I would say in the short to medium term rather than in the long term. I mean, I think there are young United players who will get a lot out of this season, led, of course, by Dan James, but there are many others. But do I see it coming together in the form of a strong team? I'm not 100% convinced.
I think that when you look at the two teams and you compare them, for me, I think Arsenal will finish above Manchester United. I don't know exactly where in the table, but I think that they are a much better team and they have better individual players, in my opinion, at the moment that are performing than Manchester United do right now. I think we've already seen with United that injuries to a couple of key players can really affect them. If Pogba's out the team, Martial's out the team, if Marcus Rashford picks up an injury.
And he's not been playing well at the moment, which is really affecting them.
And if Harry Maguire gets an injury, I mean, this team will almost fall apart without kind of that solid spine that we talked about earlier on in the season, at the start of the season, that they'd been kind of building around. So I think that Arsenal are better set to finish above Manchester United. And it's purely because they have a goal scorer in Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who I think is absolutely brilliant.
Well, it was a tremendous finish, like you say, Jules. And I feel at this point, maybe we should stick up, or maybe I should stick up for the reffing team a little bit, because we've got Jake Callahan who's written in, is that the worst call from a linesman ever? And Alan Cresswell saying, can you imagine VAR
Aaron
not...
Cresswell?
Alan.
Oh, Alan.
I think it's his brother. Can you imagine VAR not existing for that Aubameyang goal? Which I think is a good point. If there's ever a moment that's going to convince you, going to convince anyone that VAR is a good thing, that's it.
Offside. I mean, said it last week, didn't we?
I feel very inclined to say that's reasonable human error. It's very easy to sit there and look at the slow-mo and say, oh, well, that's obvious. He's clearly onside. And when you freeze it, yeah, he is clearly onside. But it's not frozen. It's a live football match.
And it's very quick. It's a lot quicker than it may look.
Exactly. You're talking about modern football, which is more athletic and more faster than football ever before. We're talking about Aubameyang, who is absolutely lightning quick still, despite getting to 30. And I think as well, if you look at the freeze frame from when the ball is played through by Saka, who I thought was really, really good again, by the way. That's a question that Incognito Football has sent in for us. Thoughts on Saka. I thought he was terrific again. When the ball's leaving his foot, Aubameyang is behind Maguire, of course. We know that when we see the freeze frame. But he's very much facing forward, of course. And Harry Maguire is leaning the other way, which I can understand, especially when you work out that that's happening in real time. I can understand where the assistant's coming from.
And also the linesman, we don't know what his eye line was at the time. He could have been looking in a, you know, not looking across his line there, which I don't know if that's meant to be.
He was stood right next to Harry Maguire.
Yeah, but he could have been sort of looking in another direction and not quite seeing the exact... We're kind of acting this out at the moment, which I know you can't see. But like you say, it's human error, and that's what VAR is there for. And, yeah. And we talked about the pros and the cons of it last week, and without going kind of too deep into it, again, one of the main pros for me is that we won't ever see an offside goal ever again in the Premier League, which has to be a plus. And in situations like this, goals like that will be allowed because we'll be able to go back and correct them.
And Aubameyang was asked about, wasn't he, in the flash about what he felt about the joy of it being curtailed. The joy of it wasn't curtailed at all.
Got to celebrate
it was
twice.
They didn't really celebrate the first time because the flag was up, didn't they? But the fact that there was that delayed reaction,
yeah,
it was fantastic. I really like that. I actually quite enjoyed that.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing is with Arsenal, when you've got a player like him who's such a good finisher, they will win games when they don't deserve to win games. I'm not saying that was the case last night.
Yes.
But when you've got someone that can score goals, it doesn't matter how bad you are defensively. We've seen it with Liverpool this season. They've not been at their defensive best, but they've still managed to win games because their front three are so good going forward. And I think Arsenal have got that with Aubameyang. They've got a player who, even when Arsenal play bad, will still score goals.
So in summary, if he keeps scoring and Bernd Leno has a blinder of a season, they're going to finish in the top four.
Probably.
Like and just busk the rest.
That's what it's looking like at the moment, yeah, though, isn't yeah. it? It is. There's never a dull moment being an Arsenal fan right now, because they can be so shocking at the back, but then brilliant going forward. And then all of a sudden you've got a game on your hands, and they've showed character the last two matches to come back from being a goal or so down to come back and get something out of the game.
Yeah, I've noticed defensively. I don't think Socrates has any tears left in him. I think he's all cried out.
One of the other things we spotted, Andy, when we were watching the game together, is we were analysing how different footballers look in the rain with wet hair. We spotted a few what we thought were bald patches, didn't we? We're like, are they aging? They've aged right before our eyes in the rain.
Yeah, well,
David,
it's up north.
You were trying to picture David Luiz with a bald patch and a ponytail.
Yeah, I was. I can see him fronting a Brazilian status quo tribute band.
Not a good look at all.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of the Football Ramble is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life throws many different challenges at us, and as a result, we all have our own sources of stress. Whether big or small, those stresses can impact our lives in unpredictable ways, and if we don't address them, they can have an outsized and unwanted impact. Therapy is a safe place in which we can address these issues, learn to understand them, and find ways to work through them. Having therapy can be beneficial to anybody, not just people who've experienced major traumas, even if you may have not considered it before. It could be simply a time for you to get things off your chest, a way to learn positive coping skills, or how to set boundaries. Ultimately, it can be whatever you need it to be. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire and BetterHelp will match you to a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/ramble.
We've got to look at the situation and say he's got more points than Rafa got last year at this moment in time. And I still don't know why Steve's getting some stick. Rafa didn't get any stick and Steve is. I just don't understand it. But there we go.
It's the moment that you've been waiting for, Newcastle United fans. Mm-hmm. But if you want your team discussed, or if you don't want your team discussed, just as importantly, or you want us to discuss a more general issue, because we had a lot of feedback on the VAR chat from last week that we'll get to in a bit. You can mail us, of course, julesandandy@footballrambledaily.com. You can always tweet us @JulesBreach, @AndyBrassel, @FootballRamble. We are going to talk about Newcastle United, who had a pretty grim Sunday, a black Sunday, as Cypress Hill would have it.
It wasn't good, was it? Bless them. I do feel bad for Newcastle at the moment because nothing is going their way.
The thing is, I looked at that before the start and I didn't have any money on it, but I did think they're going to get absolutely thrashed.
Well,
Leicester look decent at the moment. And then you factor in the Hayden sending off before half time. I mean, it was interesting afterwards to hear Steve Bruce saying how disappointed he was and to say he expected more from the team when they went a man down. But essentially, it really make a massive amount of difference. I mean, they weren't going to get anything out of it, a goal down and down to 10 men. I understand that effort is the bare minimum you expect, but I thought Micah Richards made some really interesting points on it on Match of the Day too.
He did, yeah.
Where he was saying, you know, when it's one of those days, when you're 1-0 down to a better team and you go down to 10 men, you feel that you're still putting it in, but nothing's really happening. It becomes hard to give everything. Mm. I understand where he's coming from there.
I completely get where he's coming from there. Leading into the match, I'll tell you how much faith I had in Newcastle getting something from Leicester. I transferred in 2 players into my fantasy team. Both Leicester players.
Really?
I transferred in both a defender, Soenchu, and an attacker in Tillemans. So
right.
That's how much faith I had in Newcastle. I knew that Leicester would keep a clean sheet.
And just your luck. The only two didn't score.
Honestly, I know. I thought that as well. I thought, because I had Maddison in my team before, so I needed to swap him. And I didn't want to lose out on any Leicester attack, but I couldn't get a striker in. So
that's the thing, of course. You make a great point. They did it without James Maddison.
They did it without Maddison in the team. He was watching on in the crowd, smiling from ear to ear, as he always is, a happy man at the moment.
Yeah.
But Leicester were excellent. Newcastle, I mean, they were pretty dreadful. So the thing is Leicester are a very, very good team right now, but Newcastle didn't really make it difficult for them, did they?
No, they didn't. But I would say, how much are they capable of making it difficult under current conditions? I think that the best they can hope for, and I guess use the Tottenham game as a template, is they go away from home, they set up pretty much as they would have under Rafa Benitez, and the other team doesn't play that well, and they just tough it out. In this game, if Leicester got a goal, an early-ish goal, it was always going to be too steep a climb, because the difference between the two teams and their current playing resources is so large. Now, I can understand from a Newcastle fan's perspective, you're looking at that and thinking, well, hang on, we've got a stadium that's nearly twice the size of ours. Why shouldn't we be in the position that they were? And you look at that, and it is an endemic failure in terms of the way the clubs run. There's no doubt about that, because, you know, they're in receipt of the Premier League money. They get over 50,000 fans every week, even with fans really getting the hump and a lot of them feeling that it's a completely hopeless situation. Mm-hmm. They're still getting 45,000 bums on seats, even though it looks as if that support is actually beginning to ebb away. So, you know, I think the frustration really in recent years, I suppose, for Newcastle fans has been like being outgunned in the transfer market by progressive teams like Brighton, like Huddersfield were when that they first came up. When you're being outspent by those and those teams are getting players that maybe you should be interested in, that's when it begins to feel a bit hopeless, I think.
You mentioned the fans there a moment ago, and just reflecting back on last weekend when Newcastle hosted Brighton at St James's Park, there were actually quite a few empty seats, which is not something we're used to seeing at St James's Park.
It's conspicuous, isn't it?
They have an extraordinary fan base, and they're such a hugely well-supported team in the Premier League. And we've seen that even when they've gone down to the Championship and then bounced back again. Their support is... They're diehard supporters, aren't they? And they were brilliant at the King Power Stadium. Even when the team were 3-4, 5-0 down, they were still there singing and clapping and cheering their players on. So fair play to the Newcastle supporters for being there. But I'm completely with you on this one, Andy. I just think that they're just in a bad position right now to be able to do a great deal more against these bigger, better sides in terms of a Leicester City who are playing very well at the moment, against your Liverpools, your Manchester Cities, obviously. And it's hard to compete with them when the infrastructure at the club and everything that's happening with Mike Ashley at the moment, I don't feel like they're in the position where they can compete.
No, they're not, Jules. And I mean, an afternoon like this is demoralising, but ultimately it's not the sort of game that's going to make or break the season, because Leicester are in a different part of the league to them at the moment. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And really, you know, the ones that are going to matter to them is Brighton the previous week. And when they play Villa and Southampton and teams like that, they're the ones that are going to matter. But for those fans, you know, you can understand just those empty seats and just the weariness, the feeling that nothing is ever going to change. And, I know some people in some quarters mock the catchphrase from last season, if Rafa goes, we go. But it's not just about Rafa Benitez himself, is it? It's about what he represents, because he was really the last beacon of hope. They had a head coach there who was a far better pedigree of head coach than they could have rightfully expected. When you look at where the club's been and how the club's been run in the last decade, and he was someone very much like a manager who takes in a star player who's never quite fired and thinks, you know what, maybe I can be the guy to change him. Maybe I can be the guy to make this player realise his potential. And it's probably not going to happen, but you're convincing yourself that you can be the one to do that. And I think when Rafa Benitez saw Newcastle United, he actually saw a lot of Liverpool in them, because they're a club that uniquely connects with their local area. And most of the fans, the large majority of the fan base, just get it. You know, they've got such an affinity with their club. And he thought, well, you know what? If I can get a little bit more money, if I can convince the owner of my plan, then maybe I can get us somewhere. Maybe I can get us back into the top half of the table regularly. Maybe I can get us into Europe. And because of the club, Newcastle is a unique club. They're not just another club who hasn't won anything for ages. If you go up there and you spend time there, most of those fans don't have unreasonable expectations. What they have is a club that's absolutely central to the city. Like, geographically, you can walk there in 10 minutes from the central station. You just walk out of the shops and the pubs and it's there. It's not like a normal football ground. You've got this massive 55,000 capacity football ground right in the middle of the city centre, which is an extraordinary privileged position. And it really affects the way that fans think about their club and feel about their club. And Rafa Benitez was clearly very taken by that and thought, if I can just get a little bit of resource, if I can just get a little bit of backing for my plan, I can create something special here. Because he was someone who didn't just want to do better with the team, but he was someone who invested in the community. And just like his family really embraced life in Liverpool, and of course his family still live there, he really embraced life in Newcastle as well. You know, he'd go and spend time with underprivileged people in the area, disabled supporters clubs. He was involved with the fans. lots of stuff that he didn't do for publicity, but just because he felt the affinity with the people. And that's why they responded to him. Yeah. It wasn't just that his team got stuck in and made the best of their limited abilities. So when he went, it was like a bit of hope was extinguished in a way. And, you know, I understand a lot of people in the media have stuck up for Steve Bruce and saying, oh, well, people aren't giving him a chance. It was never about Steve Bruce. And it's not about Steve Bruce right now.
It'd have been the same whoever took the job after Rafa.
And maybe Steve Bruce, you could say, is not up to the job. I think that's open for debate. And I think it's open for debate whether they could have got anyone better than him in the circumstances and with the club having the image around football and in the general public that it does at the moment. But it's not about Steve Bruce, and Newcastle fans know that. It's not really what they wanted, but if you fire him, I don't know, does it make an enormous amount of difference? Does it transform the squad? Maybe you can get a coach that can do a little bit better than him, but maybe you can't. I mean, say if they'd have gone for the Cowley brothers, for example, which would have been a far more exciting idea, for example, would they have come? I like to think maybe they'd have seen the possibility, maybe they'd have seen the opportunity. But football's a pretty small community, and people talk, don't they, Jules? And I think when you talk to people, that they know what a hospital pass that job is.
It was going to be a difficult job for whoever took over after Rafa Benitez because of all the things you've just said there. He was this shining light on that club when they were going, when they were and are still going through a really tough time at the moment with the owner. And Steve Bruce just isn't seen as an aspirational choice. And
no,
I think that's the problem, is that with Rafa, they had a manager who has an extraordinary CV, first of all. He has pedigree behind him. And then on top of that, the fans absolutely loved him and really took to him. And the difference with Steve Bruce is that he doesn't have those elements that you've just described there with Rafa Benitez. And for that reason, there's going to be a shorter tolerance from the fans because of it. It's going to be easier for the fans to dislike him. It's going to be easier for them to say, oh, this isn't working, you know, let's get rid of him, let's get someone else in. But when you put that on top of the fact that there's all the problems going on off the pitch with the board, as well as the fact that the performances on the pitch aren't delivering, this then collectively looks very messy.
Yeah, it does. And I just wonder how many times it would take them to get relegated, because obviously they've been relegated twice in the Mike Ashley era already, for Ashley to say, you know what, this just isn't worth it anymore. You know, he's felt close before, but where is the cutoff point? Mm. Because you've got an owner who doesn't even seem to see how important it is. You know, you can say all he cares about is the TV money, but yet he doesn't seem to care enough to want to protect it. Because if I was in his position and say I only did care about pocketing the TV money and I didn't really want to win anything, I would be saying, well, you know what? We've got to have the best coach possible at a certain budget. So, you know, probably Rafa Benitez. And we've got to spend a bit more on players to make sure we stay up. Even if you're just at that Watford level. I mean, obviously, on this season, not actually, a great example.
Actually, above Watford right now.
but on the whole, you look at Watford. They've not spent a fortune since they've been up, but they've never been close to getting relegated. Certainly not before this season.
Now,
and we'll see how that pans out. But I think with a little bit more effort, Mike Ashley could actually make his life a lot more comfortable, as well as making following Newcastle United a more edifying experience for the people who pour their heart and soul into it every week.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge for Steve Bruce to kind of get things ticking on the pitch. It was the first time since 2018 in December against Fulham that Newcastle didn't have a single shot on target in an entire 90 minutes.
You see, I was expecting you were going to say 2015, but no, 2018.
Yeah, it's over, just under a year. But
They didn't have a shot on target in a game against Fulham.
Yeah, I know.
Is that right?
Game finished 0-0 last year.
Oh, my God.
But this is the thing, is that it's not working on the pitch. And Steve Bruce had some really strong words to say in his post-match press conference. I think the reporter, I forget who it was, asked him, what did you say to the players after the game? And he said, I don't think you want to know. It's not worth repeating. And I was thinking to myself, I really want to know now what you said to the players.
What didn't he say, have the day off?
Is that it? That's a bit disappointing.
He cancelled training, didn't he? Because he was so annoyed.
It's a bit boring.
Yeah.
I was expecting some stronger words than that.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of French fitness coach at South Africa 2010 throwing his stopwatch in the bushes when they refused to come off the bus.
Amazing. Oh, excellent. Well, as always, we love hearing from you guys. You can tweet us at Jules Breach, at Andy Brassel, or if you'd prefer to send us something a little bit longer, send us a bit of a story, then it's julesandandy@footballrambledaily.com. And loads of you have been in touch this week once again, so thank you.
Yeah, lots VAR related. Some of them have got great titles, like James Hood's one, Don't Mention the VAR. I like that. Very, very nice, James. Adam Johns has sent one in as well. Hello Jules and Andy, the amount of zooming in on the still image for VAR plus drawing of lines takes an amount of time that is never going to give a positive experience for anyone watching. My idea for policing offside is that the VAR official should look at a still image from when the ball is played, and unless they can give an affirmative offside with the naked eye, then this is onside, similar to the forward pass rule in rugby. Cheers, really enjoying the show. And that's one of a number about VAR. We've got one from Oliver Carlton regarding seventh place in the Premier League. Afternoon or first email I've ever sent into a podcast. Love the new show. Makes my commute as a teacher even better. Thank you.
Thanks,
Oliver. I'm a Middlesbrough fan.
Oh, my dad, he feels your pain.
You love that already, don't you? And I was listening to your thoughts on the ceiling on England's glorious top division and fans being bored. I wonder what you thought about the opposite. Is it really what some clubs should strive for? I remember the lovely days of Steve Hare Island McLaren and coming back against Bucharest. Surely teams like Palace should look to teams like Leicester and Thinley. That's it. That's what we want. Keep up the good work, guys, and good luck to Brighton this season.
Oh, thanks for that.
He's ticking all your boxes, isn't he?
Is he making this up? He's not a Borough fan and he's not wishing Brighton good luck at all. Have you just made that one up, Andy?
No. I've not made it up. My favourite one this week, though, is from Paul Holloway, which says, hey, Jules and Andy, just listening to a pod from Tuesday. If you like pizza and you find yourself in Melbourne, then try 400 Gradi. They do some awesome Neapolitan pizza. They've supposedly won several Pizza World Championships in recent years. Cheers, Paul. Do you reckon we could...
Paul, that's a bit far.
Sign that off on expenses?
Do you reckon? I don't think so. thank you so much, as always, for listening. And thanks for all of your correspondence. JulesandAndy@footballrambledaily.com to get yours in for next week. I'm heading to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium tonight to watch them take on Bayern Munich. Can they
Wunderbar.
Get a win? Oh, it's going to be exciting. Looking forward to it. More Champions League action. What are you up to this week, Andy?
I'm going to be on the other half of North London. I'm going to be at Arsenal Standard Liège on Thursday.
Wonderful. Enjoy.
Hopefully
that.
They'll be bringing some waffles. Everyone loves a Liège waffle, right?
Love a waffle. Love a waffle.
That's a great
Final
way
words.
To end it. I love it.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.